And we're very pleased that Paul is going to do us a meeting on Castro, Cuba and socialism.
I've broken this meeting into just a couple of parts. Briefly, I'm going to talk a little bit about Cuba itself, then about Fidel Castro on his own, and then basically mix the two of them together. Cuba is located in the Northern Caribbean. The capital city is Havana, and it is the largest island in the Caribbean. It's about 100,000 square kilometres in area, and it's got a population of about 11 million inhabitants. It was colonised by the Spanish in the 15th century after the arrival of Columbus, and prior to this it was actually inhabited by three main indigenous tribes. Once Columbus and the Spanish took over, basically these tribes were largely made extinct because they had no immunity to infectious disease such as smallpox and so forth. The first rebellion against Spain seeking independence was in 1868. But the person who really advanced the sort of independence movement was José Martí. Martí traveled extensively and whatever, and he actually formed the Cuban Revolutionary Party in New York in 1892. He went on to actually fight the Spanish on Cuban soil, but he didn't actually live to see independence become a reality, because he was actually killed in battle in 1895. He is actually a national hero in Cuba. Martí was an interesting character because he wrote extensively. He was a poet and so forth, and he was actually a major influence on Castro. Castro read all his works and whatever. I think everybody know the song Guantanamera. They are Martí's words. He wrote a book of poems called A Simple Verse, and Guantanamera is four verses taken from different poems and so forth, but that's his claim to fame. The actual War of Independence in 1898 was successful, but this was sort of almost immediately overturned by Cuba, who imposed an amendment on the Cuban constitution called the Platt Amendment. And this amendment gave America control over areas such as the police and customs and this sort of stuff. And it's also responsible for Guantanamo Bay. This is why the Americans still have this base in Cuba. For the next 30 years or so this is like just after they get independence, but America still had a major influence. America dominated Cuba's sugar industry, which literally was their only industry at the time. But all its hotels, casinos, and unfortunately the sex industry was controlled by the mafia. I don't know if anybody saw the Godfather 2 film. There's a scene in there where the mafia are talking about their exploits in Cuba and Havana in particular. In 1929, the U.S. economy went into crisis. So basically, we remember that they were the main importer of Cuban sugar and whatever, but the U.S. economy went into crisis, and this led to extreme hardship for the Cuban people. And in 1933, another revolution erupted, which was actually led by the workers, the Havana transport workers. This briefly saw Soviets being formed, which were sort of workers' councils and so forth. But a revolt by army officers saw a dictatorship of Batista come to power. And this guy, Batista, he remained in power for the next 25 years. Castro himself, he was born in 1926 on the 13th of August, and he died a couple of weeks ago, 25th of December 2016, at the age of 90. He was a Cuban politician and a revolutionary who governed the Republic of Cuba as prime minister from 1959 to 67. And then as president from 67 until 2008, so there's no gaps there. Politically, he was a Marxist, a Leninist, and but more importantly, a Cuban nationalist. He also served as first secretary of the Communist Party in Cuba from 1961 until 2011. Under his administration, Cuba became a one-party socialist state. Industry and businesses were nationalized, and state socialist reforms were implemented throughout society. In 1945, Castro studied law in Havana, and that's where he became politically sort of active. He got involved in student activism and so forth, and he stood for president of the sort of equivalent of the Students' Union, on actually an anti-American, anti-imperialist ticket. He was unsuccessful, but later campaigned against the corruption of the then Cuban president, Ramon Grau, I think that's how you pronounce it, and his government. And that actually brought him into the sort of public spotlight. In 1947, Cuba actually joined an expedition to overthrow the right-wing junta in the Dominican Republic, which is another island in the Caribbean nearby. However, this expedition was stopped from sailing from Cuba, so he never actually took part in it. But in 1948, he got involved in clashes against the Colombian government. So he was sort of cutting his teeth in sort of guerrilla warfare and this sort of stuff. Batista's dictatorship grew in violence and vicious repression, which was directed at the discontent of the lower middle classes and the large student arrest. So right throughout Batista's dictatorship, he was a dictator, but there was a lot of opposition to him. And in 1953, Castro led a movement on the 26th of July against the Moncada barracks and Batista's rule. Although the July 26th movement was reasonably large, it had about 1,400 members at the time. Castro only used a small number in the attack because this was where he was sort of exploring his sort of guerrilla warfare sort of tactics. And many were killed, and Castro was actually captured and imprisoned, and he remained there until 1955. So he basically he only did about 2 years in prison. He was sentenced to 15 years, but he only did about 2 years because Batista actually granted an amnesty to the political prisoners from that time with the support of the US, because so that he could gain some popularity and maybe dampen opposition to him. However, the opposition continued in the forms of bombings and demonstrations and so forth, and Batista responded with even harsher crackdown on dissidents. Because there was a big crackdown, Castro and his brother Raul, they went to Mexico to avoid arrest at that point. And of course, in Mexico, he met Che Guevara. While he was in Mexico, he remained sort of in contact with the political activists in Cuba and so forth. And his 26th of July movement was renamed to the MR-26-7 movement in his absence. But it continued to grow, along with other anti-Batista militant groups on the island. In 1956, he was actually back in the island, so he wasn't abroad for very long. And for the next 3 years, he led various sort of guerrilla campaigns against Batista, which ended in 1959 when Batista actually went into exile. And apparently, I think he absconded with something like $300 million or something like that. Castro's M26 movement took power, with Castro becoming the Prime Minister of Cuba on February the 16th. Castro enjoyed popular support from the beginning, really from below, but he quickly had to introduce social reforms, and he had to be seen to be dealing with Batista's torturers and the secret police. They were put on public trial and executed. Castro made all his co-rebels into senior positions in the administration. So, for example, Che Guevara became the governor of the Central Bank of Cuba and the Minister of Industries. Castro's revolution consisted of a handful of armed revolutionaries with little involvement from the organized working class. But I'm asking a question at this point, could this have been different? Because, for example, it's largely ignored in Cuban history that around the 1950s, Cuba actually had the highest percentage of trade union membership in Latin America. And right throughout the 50s, there was a sort of a Trotskyist rank and file network was actually emerging amongst the working class. And bear in mind, I said the population of Cuba is about 11 million. In 55, there was a massive strike by sugar workers. Over 500,000 of these went on strike. They were supported as well by transport workers, and I think so, you know, you had a big percentage of the Cuban population actually on strike, but still Castro led his revolution, which is a handful of armed revolutionaries and so forth. However, there was a problem with the trade union bureaucracy. We have to point that out. They were the leader of the trade union. He was an anti-communist, and he was corrupt and actually cooperated with Batista to attack the unions, and they did a sort of salami job as well, I think, you know, a bit like Ridley and Thatcher when they attacked the unions in the UK. They attacked them one at a time. When Castro was in power, sometimes huge mass meetings were held, but decisions at these meetings always came from the top. So this is why all these decisions came from the top rather than from the sort of mass decision making, and this process differed hugely from the decision making process which characterized the Russian Revolution in 1917 after its socialist revolution, and I'm going to give two quotes here. In 1961, Che Guevara said, "The leaders of this country, in close identification with the people, consider what is best for the people and put that into numbers and send them down from the top." If we contrast that with what Lenin said in 1917, the working class was break up, smash up the ready-made state machinery and not confine itself to merely taking hold of it. So we can see the sort of contrast between the two approaches. Again, I'm just reiterating that Castro sort of ruled from the top down and didn't allow proper democratic decision making, even actually in his own administration. I mean, the Communist Party didn't actually have any Congress of sort until 1975. So Castro actually ruled without even having a Congress amongst his own administration. Castro's administration undoubtedly benefits the Cuban people, and I think everybody in this room is aware that education and free health service and so forth in Cuba, it was absolutely world class. Cuba's literacy rates were 99.8%, and it's one of the highest in the world. And this is a result of free education right across the board at all levels, right up to university and so forth. Cuban doctors and medical staff are famed worldwide, and Cuba is credited for making a significant contribution to world health since the 19th century. I mean, this is really good stuff, but again, we need to remember that what Castro actually did with Cuban doctors and so forth, he almost used them as a sort of exports. He sent the doctors abroad and got some money back from them. But Castro himself and his administration is probably best known for its resistance to US imperialism. His victory against the CIA-backed attempt to overthrow his regime in 61 increased his popular support. And this was, of course, the Bay of Pigs invasion. And he fought that off. And he survived hundreds of assassination attempts. But the US kept up economic pressure, and US-owned refineries refused to start processing Russian oil because what Castro did was made a relationship with Russia and started importing Russian oil and so forth. So what Castro did then was he nationalized all the industries and whatever. And then this led to the US trade embargo being imposed by the US, which actually is largely in place to this day. Cuba became increasingly reliant on Russia for trade, and this economic relationship with Russia eventually led to Castro adopting the sort of Soviet model, both economically and politically. And this brought Cuba to center stage in 1962 at the height of the Cold War with the Cuban missile crisis. Castro will be rightly criticized as well for his human rights record. His prosecution of LGBT and people was horrendous. He arrested these people, he put them into forced labor camps, he introduced special education for gays who acted effeminately and so forth. And he did apologize for this later, but it did go on, and you know, he's rightly criticized for it. But he has also influenced socialist revolutionaries around the world for the last 50 years. So as I said, himself and Che Guevara, you know, not everybody comes to socialism through their policies. But certainly that image of Che Guevara and so forth, it really does have an influence. And you see it on lots of demos and so forth. When you go to London, people wearing the T-shirts and whatever. But he was called a tyrant by those who sort of backed the Pinochet military coup and who currently prop up the Saudi regime. So what I'm trying to say here is, while we will rightly, as socialists, as revolutionary socialists, why we will rightly criticize him, we will not stand with these people who call him a tyrant and a dictator. While, I mean, Trump called him a brutal dictator, and Trump, you know, in his campaign said he would expand Guantanamo Bay, he would increase waterboarding and do even worse. So, you know, we don't stand with these people in our criticism of Castro. Our criticism of Castro is more on how he developed Cuba as a socialist society and so forth. In 1960, the editors of the International Journal wrote, "Firstly, the Cuban Revolution was an important defeat for American imperialism. Secondly, it is unlike a socialist revolution in that it has not created a kind of political institutions which would permanently express mass participation. And thirdly, the Cubans only turned to Russia power because there was no power of the international working class for them to turn to." So basically what they're trying to get at here is when Cuba had its revolution, the idea of having a revolution in one country, it's just not going to work. And there was an attempt to sort of spread the revolution around Latin America, and Castro, as I think people would probably be aware, traveled to Latin America and so forth to try to spread the revolution. And of course, he, in Bolivia, with a CIA-backed attack, he was murdered. So it didn't really take off at that time. The revolution remained isolated as attempts to spread it across Latin America failed. However, the socialism Castro tried to achieve is as important as ever, but this can only be achieved by mass collective struggle of the working class and not state control from above. And I just want to finish off this part with a sort of an extended quote, and it's from a pamphlet written by Hal Draper. Hal Draper is an American socialist, and he wrote this in 1966, and basically that he was exploring the meaning of socialism. The pamphlet is called The Two Souls of Socialism, and the final chapter, which is entitled Which Side Are You On, I'm actually going to quote the final paragraph from that chapter. Since the beginning of society, there has been no end of theories proving that tyranny is inevitable and that freedom in democracy is impossible. There is no more convenient ideology for a ruling class and its intellectual flunkies. These are self-fulfilling predictions, since they remain true only as long as they are taken to be true. In the last analysis, the only way of proving them false is in the struggle itself. The struggle from below has never been stopped by the theories of those from above, and it has changed the world time and time again. To choose any of the forms of socialism from above is to look back to the old world, to the old crap. To choose the road of socialism from below is to affirm the beginning of a new world. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.